Homo Viator. This is man on a journey or man on a quest. Even in the pagan world, as we see from the vision of the afterlife, the same concept of Homo Viator and that metaphysical, theological level would apply to Homer as it applies to any Christian author. Go.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Hello, I'm Joseph Pierce, and welcome to another Faith and Culture podcast with the Augustine Institute. And today we're continuing our survey of literature, what every Catholic should know, looking at the whole panoramic landscape of the literature of Western civilization, beginning with the ancient Greeks, with Homer, and going right through to the 20th century. So in the first of the podcast, which launched this series, I talked about faith and reason and storytelling in the history of both the Jews and the Greeks and the pagans. And then we concluded by discussing Homer in general, and then Homer's epic, the Iliad in particular. Well, I'm going to recommence our study of the pagan world and pagan literature with Homer's other great epic, the Odyssey. So as Tolkien has said, and as Hamlet says, that the purpose of art is to hold up a mirror to man, is to show us ourselves. The purpose of the humanities is to show us our humanity. So one thing we see as a recurring theme throughout literature over the past 2,500 years and more, almost 3,000 years, is showing who we are, and in particular showing our tendency to be evil, our tendency to be bad, and that is summed up in the phrase for man, mankind, as homo superbus, proud man who makes himself God and defies God and all other people in order to do his own thing, so to speak. So in the Iliad, we saw Achilles as homo superbus personified, if you like, and the consequences of his pride, which is his fall. Well, in the Odyssey, we see another aspect, another facet of who we are, and that's summed up in another Latin phrase, homo viator. This is man on a journey or man on a quest or traveling man. It's the understanding of our life story, our own individual life story, as being first of all a story, but also our life story being a life journey, a journey with a quest, with a purpose. Now, obviously, from a Christian perspective, that is to get to heaven, to be with God forever in his presence in the company of the saints. But even in the pagan world, as we see from the vision of the afterlife, which we get in the Odyssey, that there was a belief that the virtue was rewarded after death and that sin was punished. So the same concept of homo viator and that metaphysical, theological level would apply to Homer as it applies to any Christian author. Perhaps not identically, but certainly in the spirit of the thing. But also homo viator in the Odyssey in the more mundane sense of Odysseus's own journey home. Okay, the purpose of Odysseus's quest in the Odyssey is to get home, and home here is where the family is. It's where his wife is. It's where his son is. It's where his people are. It's where his household is. So it's to be reunited with home, hearth, and family, wife, child. This is the purpose of Homer's quest in the Odyssey. And again, we see what he has to do in order to get home. is to grow in wisdom and virtue. So you actually follow the chronological path of the story, and the Odyssey is a little bit complex in its structure, so it doesn't begin at the beginning of the story. Most of the story is actually told by Homer in retrospect. But if you take the chronology of the story, Odysseus and his men, when they leave Troy following the fall of Troy, which is of course told is the subject of the Iliad, the previous epic, when they leave Troy, they're basically a bunch of pirates. So we first see them raping and pillaging and getting drunk on the beach, having raped and pillaged the poor hapless Ciconians, breaking the law of Xenia, which was central to the Greeks, this idea that one must if not love one's neighbor, at least respect one's neighbor and treat one's neighbor and one's guest with civility, because particularly Xenius, or particularly one's guest with civility, because it's possible that that guest might be a god or goddess in disguise, so therefore you must be on your best behavior when you're playing host. Well, this fundamental law of Greek ethics and morality was broken by Odysseus and his men in their raping and pillaging of the Ciconians. So that's how they begin. And then we see various other aspects of pride. It's pride and arrogance and general sinfulness, which leads to the destruction of the entirety of Odysseus's crew. But another aspect that delays Odysseus's homecoming is his own pride, particularly his boastfulness, his unwillingness to remain merely as no one or nobody in his dealings with the Cyclops, Polyphemus, and his boastfulness, saying that I am the great Odysseus. We're in this, if you like, original sin of pride is his fall, because he is cursed. The Cyclops prays to the gods, and in consequence to Poseidon in particular, and in consequence Poseidon is allowed by Zeus, the father of the gods, to delay Homer's journey home. He's not allowed to destroy him or prevent the journey home from eventually being achieved, but all of the quest, the many years that Odysseus is away from home, trying to get home, is a consequence of his own pride and arrogance. So we see, as with the Iliad, we see Homer showing us that pride precedes a fall. Okay, but let's look at one or two of the other characters in the Odyssey before we move on. In Penelope, Odysseus' wife, we have really the strongest and most virtuous character in the whole work, as with characters in Shakespeare, such as Portia and especially perhaps Cordelia. They don't necessarily have most of the lines. Certainly Cordelia has relatively few lines in King Lear, but she is an absolute, not just a paragon of virtue, but a tower of strength, of fortitude. Well, Penelope is the same. She's, if you like, the original indomitable heroine in Western literature. We also see that Telemachus, the son of Odysseus and Penelope, he also has to grow up. And growing up is not just growing in size and in strength, but growing in wisdom and virtue. So Odysseus ultimately has to embrace humility. He comes home not in glory, but dressed as a beggar, and has to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. He has to suffer being brutalized and assaulted by the very suitors who are trying to seduce his own wife. So he has to, if you like, embrace the path of humility and poverty in order to ultimately achieve and attain the reward. And again, as with the Iliad, in the Odyssey, it's the will of Zeus that's accomplished. And there is, we can't of course say of Homer that he's a monotheist, that he believes in one god, but it's quite clear in the Odyssey that Zeus has more strength than all of the other gods put together. And if all the other gods opposed Zeus's will, it's certainly heavily implicit that Zeus's will would still be accomplished. And if that's the case, if this one god is more powerful than all the other gods put together, it's not a million miles theologically from a Christian understanding of the cosmos, in the sense of there being the one all-powerful God, but under him there are supernatural beings, some of which are good, angels, and some of which are evil, demons. So this battle between the angels and the demons is not that dissimilar from the, should we say, the dysfunctional relationship between many of the Greek gods. But where does Zeus fit into the picture? And he does seem to be the ultimately the wise God whose will is accomplished and who has more power than the rest of the gods put together. So something at least approaching monotheism in the theology that underpins the Odyssey. Okay, let's say a little bit about Sophocles before we move on into the Christian era. So Sophocles is the father, really, of drama. And for me, he is the greatest dramatist who ever lived, with the exception of Shakespeare. And the Oedipus cycle, which is three plays, Antigone, then Oedipus Rex, and Oedipus at Colonus. These three plays are wonderful, ultimately a wonderful meditation on the meaning of suffering, on our response to suffering, and the holiness to be attained from the acceptance and embrace of suffering. At least this is the two plays, Oedipus Rex and Oedipus at Colonus, because Oedipus in those two plays comes to realize that he's a man like King Lear, who's more sinned against than sinning, and his life of suffering and blindness as a consequence of things that were beyond his ken and understanding and knowledge, and therefore culpability. So suffering for something for which he is not directly responsible allows him to come to a great degree of wisdom and indeed sanctity. And at the end of Oedipus at Colonus, he is assumed, as in the Blessed Virgin's Assumption into Heaven, well, that Oedipus is himself assumed into heaven mystically as a reward for his coming to understand the meaning of suffering, very much like the Book of Job. So another wonderful work. And in Antigone, the other play in the cycle, we see a timeless story of the struggle for religious liberty. We have a wicked, tyrannical king, Creon, who refuses Antigone the right to give her brother an appropriate religious burial. And she defies and denies Creon on the basis that the law against religious liberty is an unjust law, and that she has to give her primary allegiance, first of all, to the gods, and also to her family, to her brother, to ensure he gets a decent religious funeral. And she defies the power of the state in order to affirm her right to religious liberty. And in this, of course, we see a timeless tale that is true of all generations, not least our own generation in which we live today. Okay, so thank you for listening to the second of our series on literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. We'll return next time by entering into the Christian era by looking, first of all, at Christ as himself being a great storyteller, and then looking at some of the works of early Christian literature. So thanks for listening. My name is Joseph Pierce, and I've been your host in this Faith and Culture podcasts of the Augustine Institute. Thanks for listening. Goodbye, and God bless. Go.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pierce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.